Number 5, Patrick versus CIR. Mr. Shapiro.
Good morning. May it please the court, Dashiell Shapiro for appellants Craig and Michelle Patrick. This case comes down to the fundamental distinction between capital gains and ordinary income. Capital gains are earned when you transfer the right to earn income from an asset. Ordinary income is when you transfer the right to earned income. This is a technical distinction, but it's a fundamental one in tax law. What Mr. Patrick transferred to the government was not the right to any earned income, and it was not the value of his services. He transferred to the government the right to earn income from the confidential information, documents, and know-how that connected the dots and explained this information, that gave this information value to the government in its claim against Kaifon and its claim against the hospitals for the Medicare fraud that they had committed.
Actually, what he did was alert the government to the existence of a potential fraud, and the government took it from there.
Yes.
And, you know, the government recoups the losses associated from the fraud, and he gets a reward. Nothing is being transferred.
I would say that the structure of the False Claims Act provides that something is being transferred, and that is, you can see in the structure of the payout mechanism, there's a 15% minimum payment for relators that transfer confidential information that's not already been disclosed to the government. And the Fifth Circuit in X. Rel. Russell explained it as the government is purchasing information it might not otherwise acquire, that it's a transfer of information that's traditionally been granted capital asset treatment because it is valuable to purchasers. Here, there's only one purchaser. The purchaser is the government.
Nothing is being purchased. The language that you're referring to is just loose language. Nothing is being purchased by the government in a False Claims Act claim. That, you know, the relator is a whistleblower. He's alerting the government to a potential fraud. The government can either take over the claim or not. But here the government took over the claim, and he got a portion of the recovery as a reward for his whistleblowing efforts, which is classic standard income compensation for his sweat equity in discovering the fraud. Not some item of property that's being transferred.
The information and the documents he provided are assets that are traditionally given capital asset treatment. If you look at the
we're going to look at this, or if that's the proper way to think about this, they're not his, so he can't claim capital gains treatment for that information asset, if that's the right way to think about this.
I would say if you look at the DuPont case, it explains the difference between a patent, which is a legal monopoly, which is traditionally given capital treatment. A patent is a monopoly in law created by a legal regime that entitles the discoverer of the patent, the first person to patent an idea, know-how, a process. It gives that inventor capital treatment upon the sale of that patent.
And I think, you know, you're very creative in terms of how you're trying to get us to buy that. But, I mean, I think, you know, there's only one other case, the Alderson case out of the Ninth Circuit. You made this very same argument to that court, and it was rejected, right? That it should be treated as a capital gain.
Yes, and I think there's a number of reasons not to follow Alderson here. The primary one being the distinction I mentioned at the beginning, the distinction between the transfer of the right to earn income versus the right to earned income or ordinary income. What, and that's in the Laterra case that cites that the government cites. It's a Third Circuit case that extensively criticizes the Ninth Circuit's approach to capital gains versus ordinary income analysis. It's another lottery case, and the government tries to analogize what Mr. Patrick did to that of the cases where taxpayers tried to convert lottery winnings into capital gains. But that's not what happened here. There was no conversion of a lottery ticket or ordinary income into capital gains. Here, there was a transfer of a capital asset, which is trade secrets. It's a monopoly in fact, according to DuPont. It's like a patent, but it doesn't have the legal protections of a patent. Rather, it's a monopoly in fact, stemming from the fact that Mr. Patrick had access to confidential information and documents, and he curated this group of documents, and he added his know-how to connect the dots to give the government a valuable asset which it could earn income from. And the False Claims Act converts this monopoly, in fact, into a monopoly in law, just like a patent. The relator that comes forward with confidential information is granted a minimum 15% recovery based on the information provided, not based on the services provided. Perhaps there's additional compensation, there's additional payment that can be viewed as compensation for extraordinary services provided by a relator, but the baseline 15% is provided for the confidential documents provided. And I think, in addition to Laterra, I think a couple cases that are important to focus on are Ofria and U.S. Mineral Products, showing that documents, even when known, even when confidential documents are known by competitors or that secrecy isn't entirely maintained, if the documents, if the information, if the secret knowledge has value to the purchaser, those items are capital assets entitled to capital treatment. Here, the information Mr. Patrick provided plainly had significant value to the government and led to a $75 million recovery. And the government needed Patrick's information. They didn't need his services. They needed the information and the documents he provided. And the fact that the information is not valuable to anybody but the government doesn't undermine capital treatment. In Ofria, there's only one purchaser. That's the U.S. military. No, the information that the taxpayer provided to the government in Ofria was valuable only to the U.S. military, but that doesn't deny the fact that when you provide an asset, that an information trade secret asset to the government, it gets capital treatment upon exchange. And what Mr. Patrick exchanged, he exchanged the documents information for an interest in the lawsuit. Both of these are capital assets. When you exchange a capital asset for another capital asset, it's the treatment is capital gains. It's very clear in the case law that both confidential information and interests in lawsuits are entitled to capital gains treatment. And the fundamental mistake of the Ninth Circuit was to analogize Mr. Patrick's activity to that of a lottery winner or ordinary income for services provided. The value in what he provided to the government was the assets that the government needed for their claim. That was the secret information that he obtained about the Medicare fraud at Kyphon. The government needed that for its claim to have value, and the government clearly obtained value from that. These are assets that transfer to the government the right to earn income. That is traditional capital gains analysis. And the purpose of capital gains is twofold. I think we both talked about this in our briefs. One is to promote risk-taking in the public interest, which Mr. Patrick clearly did. The assets he provides the government clearly led to a benefit the public fisc and the public at large and protected from Medicare fraud. And it's the type of activity that should be encouraged. And two, it ameliorates the effect of taxation at the highest rate at the for an asset that appreciates in value over time. Mr. Patrick filed a lawsuit in 2005, and the payments were made in 2008 and 2009.
Now you know you're in your rebuttal time.
Okay.
So if you want to save any time, I mean, you can continue to use all your time in this argument. It's totally your choice.
Okay, I'll reserve the balance of my time. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Calderon.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the Court. My name is Richard Calderoni, and I represent the Commissioner of Internal Revenue in this appeal. There's no reason for this Court to create a conflict with the Ninth Circuit's holding that a quitam award in a False Claims Act suit is not a capital gain. Under the False Claims Act, the award that a relator receives is, as the Supreme Court said in Stevens and as this Court said in the Chovanec case and many others, it's a reward or a bounty for providing information to the government and then instituting and maintaining a quitam action. It is, in other words, a finder's fee. It's a payment for doing things for the government, and like all other types of payment for services, it's therefore ordinary income. It's therefore no surprise that Mr. Patrick has not been able to point either to a capital asset in this case or to any sale or exchange that he engaged in with the government. The information that Mr. Patrick provided can't be seen as a capital asset for numerous reasons we discussed in our brief, but perhaps most fundamentally, that information wasn't his property. As the Ninth Circuit said in Alderson, a relator has no legal right to prevent anyone else from disclosing or using the information about the alleged fraud at the root of a False Claims Act suit. And in his reply brief, Mr. Shapiro essentially conceded that Mr. Patrick couldn't have stopped his co-relator, Charles Bates, or anyone else at his company or at the hospitals who had knowledge of this alleged fraud from bringing their own quitam suit and providing similar or the same information to the government. The right to receive a quitam award also is not a capital asset, and that's for two reasons. The first, as the Ninth Circuit held in Alderson, is that right doesn't look anything like a capital asset. It involves no initial investment of capital, and contrary to what Mr. Shapiro said a few minutes ago, it never appreciates. The Supreme Court said in Stevens, citing authorities that go the whole way back to Blackstone, that the right to receive a quitam award never vests until the quitam suit results in either a favorable judgment or a settlement. In other words, the right simply arises at that time in a particular amount.
So before the company settled, Patrick had sold his interest in his relator's share to someone else, what kind of tax treatment would that get?
Under this court's decision in the Nahee case, it would be ordinary income treatment, Your Honor. Nahee says that if a legal claim is sold, you look to the origin of the claim doctrine to determine whether the proceeds of the sale are treated as ordinary income or capital gains. Under that doctrine, the proceeds are capital gains only if the claim itself is one to recover the value of a damaged or lost capital asset. And that's not the case here. As the Supreme Court said in Stevens, the claim in a quitam suit is the government's claim against the defendant. And in Mr. Patrick's suits, that claim was to recover money the government was induced to pay out for health care services under the Medicare program. That's not a suit to recover the damage of a capital asset. So even if Mr. Patrick had sold his right in the lawsuit, the income would still be taxable as ordinary income rather than as a capital gain. Finally, I want to mention that the structure of the False Claims Act itself demonstrates that there was no sale or exchange between Mr. Patrick and the government. As the Ninth Circuit said in Alderson, the relator in a False Claims Act suit provides information to the government simply as one of the procedural requirements for maintaining the suit. He doesn't get anything back. He provides information to the government so that the government can assess that information and decide whether to intervene. And at the end of the suit, if the suit is successful and the relator gets an award, that award is not part of a sale or exchange either because the government isn't getting anything in return for the award. So it's a paradigmatic illustration of the general rule in the Chamberlain case, and that's been applied in Frieda and Nahee and elsewhere, that the settlement of a lawsuit is not a sale or exchange for purposes of Section 1222. Unless the Court has any further questions, I'll finish there.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
1 minute.
Your Honor, I would urge the Court to revisit the Nahee case because in that case this Court did indicate that if an interest in a lawsuit was transferred rather than prosecuted to conclusion, the exchange would be taxed as capital gain rather than ordinary income. It's when the lawsuit is prosecuted to conclusion and then settled that Nahee states that the settlement payment is ordinary income. The court in Nahee discussed the hypothetical of transferring and having someone else prosecute the lawsuit to conclusion, and that's exactly what Mr. Patrick did here. And finally, about the issue of whether Mr. Patrick could have stopped anybody else from coming forward with the information, we discussed in our reply brief that certainly he could have stopped anybody from taking his personal curated collection of documents and the information that he had to connect the dots. His employer could not have prevented him, and moreover, the law recognizes his rights to receive a portion of the government's recovery based on the information he provided. So the False Claims Act recognizes his property right in that information, even if it doesn't say we are recognizing a property right. It, in effect, does. It grants a monopoly in fact and monopoly in law to the relator that comes forward with that information.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement. Mr. Shapiro, I know you'll be happy to get back to California and back to D.C. to a warmer climate, I hope. All right. With that, court is in recess until the next session.